A reading from the Gospel according to John. Mary Magdalene stayed outside the tomb weeping, and as she wept, she bent over the tomb and saw two angels in white sitting there, one at the head and one at the feet where the body of Jesus had been. And they said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" She said to them, "They have taken my Lord, and I don't know where they've laid him." When she had said this, she turned around and saw Jesus there, but did not know it was Jesus. Jesus said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you looking for?" She thought that it was the gardener and said to him, "Sir, if you carried him away, tell me where you laid him and I will take him." Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned and said to him in Hebrew, "Rabboni," which means teacher. Jesus said to her, "Stop holding on to me, for I have not yet ascended to the Father. But go to my brothers and tell them, I'm going to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God." Mary went and announced to the disciples, "I have seen the Lord," and then reported what he had told her. Growing up, I always heard the stories of the empty tomb as stories of resurrection. I had the impression that the disciples of Jesus went to the tomb, found it empty, and jumped for joy. I had the impression that they immediately knew he had come back to life and ran off to tell everyone else. And for the next 40 days, Jesus played a great game of hide-and-go-seek with them. It was tremendous fun. And then he moved on to heaven, and they continued to bask in the glow of the great trick they thought had been played on the laws of nature. They were happy ever after. Yes, this is what I had thought. Jesus' tomb has been found empty. Let the party begin. Of course, none of the Gospel says this. They seem to indicate that exuberance was in short supply at the discovery of the empty tomb. None more so than the Gospel of John. The beloved disciple willing to believe but not understanding. Peter simply returning home. Mary Magdalene staying behind, weeping. It behooves us to remember that before Easter morning was the bedrock of the church's joy, it was the source of the disciples' horror. I came to understand that a few years back when my husband and I suffered a miscarriage. There are many sad things about having a miscarriage, but strangely, the worst part of it was waking up from anesthesia and wondering what they had done with the tiny little remains of a being I had begun to call child. I'm not a meek or powerless woman. I can wield words quite well. But there was something about the sterile coldness of the hospital setting that made my emotions feel foolish and irrelevant. I couldn't find the courage to vocalize the strongest desire of my heart at that moment to be able to give what would have been my child a proper burial, a place in the ground where I could occasionally visit and remember and once in a while place a flower. I was haunted by the idea of this little one being treated as medical waste, lying alone without any acknowledgement of its humanity. Tombs are very important. And when the tomb is empty, there's no place to localize the grief in one's life. And so it begins to restlessly pervade every space. Motherhood is like a huge secret club. At each stage of a child's development, women come out of the woodwork to tell you all you ever wanted to know of their own stories, and sometimes a little bit more. And after this event, I was wrapped in the sorrow of all the mothers of the world who had lost their children and, worse, don't know where to find them. I don't know whether it's good pastoral care to drown a sad person in stories of much greater sadness, but to the degree that it increased my capacity for empathy, I think it was a good thing. One begins to taste inklings of the agony of the mothers of the Plaza de Mayo in Latin America, the grandmothers of the disappeared in the Congo or Sudan, the widowed of Bosnia, women who weep over loved ones whose discarding was preceded by acts of great cruelty, of torture, of war. There are a hell of a lot of empty tombs in this world, and never are they the cause of rejoicing. There are a hell of a lot of Mary Magdalene's weeping and wondering and searching for the vanished of this world, and none of their stories has a happy ending, save one. And it's a little hard to know what to do with that one. For on one level, as soon as the risen Christ makes an appearance, the parallel ends. We find that Mary's assumptions were ungrounded. It was not the gardener, or the soldier, or Al-Qaeda who snatched Jesus' body from the tomb. It was God. And we can resonate with her weeping and her wandering, and we can even stir our courage to demand his body. We know that the strength of our intent would compensate for the weakness of our physique, that in love, we too would personally carry back our beloved from any distance or location necessary to the dignity of the tomb. But can we resonate with the remainder of the story? Does the empty tomb of a risen Jesus have anything to say to the empty tombs of our world? I think perhaps two things. First, it invites us to a new relationship to the empty tomb as a place of potential for God to act. The empty tomb becomes an image of the last day. Jesus' body was the first snatched from the tomb by God, but only the first, a symbol of hope for what will happen to all of us and our loved ones at the close of time, wherever they may be and whenever this might happen. The snatching of Jesus was the beginning of the end of time. Hence, our stance before the empty tomb is no longer one of complete despair, but of waiting. Not waiting for the sin of the world to return the dead and fill that grave. Not waiting for an old relationship to be restored or brought to closure. But waiting on the faithfulness of God to do a new thing, to recreate possibilities for relationship that don't undo death, but are not obstructed by it either. It's the place of potential for a new kind of relationship. And this being so, we can also say that the empty tomb of Jesus initiates us to a way of waiting for the last day, a way of waiting for the fullness of new relationship. It's a way of living with absence. The discovery of Jesus' ongoing presence with them beyond the grave was surely a great joy for those disciples. But at the same time, this resurrected presence stuff is rough to live with. The 40 days of mysterious appearances were not a reliving of old times where they'd kick back and talk about the weather and the lilies of the field. They were a boot camp in the discipleship of waiting. An intense training in how to recognize Jesus' presence when their eyes could not see him, because eyes are not to be trusted anymore in discerning the divine touch. Rather, Mary will come to recognize him in the word, in the hearing of her name being spoken. The disciples of Emmaus will come to recognize him in the breaking of the bread. Thomas will recognize him in the touch of wounds. As the Johannine community continued to meditate on their experience, they would recognize him in light, in water, in wine overflowing. And perhaps it was only when their imagination was expanded in this way that they could begin to recognize his presence also in that Pharisee Paul, in the Gentile Cornelius, in those persons where they might have least expected. The church shows us that the way to live with absence is to live sacramentally, to live with antenna up and a heart ready for sudden breakthroughs between heaven and earth. This is the way we live in the communion of saints, some of whom are living and some of whom are dead and some of whom are missing. This is how we live in faith before every sort of tomb. The empty tomb stories are not stories of resurrection, but stories of learning to live with resurrection. And this means that if we're to celebrate Easter in the spirit of the first disciples, it should probably be about 10% balloons and banner waving and about 90% staring out the window pondering. How long did it take for their party to begin? How long did it take for that huge, gaping, empty hole in the side of the cliff to reconcile with its counterpart in their heart? How long did it learn to say, "I have seen the Lord," when one has not literally seen anything that looked like the Lord at all. Let us pray that this Easter season, our 50 days of processing, that in this time may grow within us that hardiest of hopes, that hope that lives in the hearts of Magdalene throughout the earth.